This is Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology Family of Journals. The Neurology Podcast provides practical information to neurologists and other clinicians to help them provide better care for their patients. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
Hi, this is Karen Hirsch. I'm an Associate Professor of Neurology at Stanford University. I'm really excited today to talk to Dr. Linnea Grindegård about her recent paper in Neurology titled Association Between EEG Patterns and Serum Neurofilament Light Chain After Cardiac Arrest, a Post Hoc Analysis of the TTM Trial. Thank you so much for being here, Linnea.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
I'm really excited about this paper and so fortunate to get to hear your take on it firsthand. Can you tell me a little bit about the take-home message or what you would tell the residents as we're taking care of patients with cardiac arrest?
Yeah, so we do already know that highly malignant EEG patterns after cardiac arrest are a predictor of poor neurological outcome. But studies for prediction of outcome are often criticized for permitting clinical decision-making based on the results from the same examinations, which may raise the question for a self-fulfilling prophecy. But in this study, we used a blood biomarker for axonal injury, neurofilament light, or NFL in short, as a surrogate marker for outcome. And we could demonstrate that the highly malignant EEG patterns are indeed associated with severe brain injury expressed in highly elevated levels of NFL.
I thought it was really interesting how you all paired the EEG with the serum biomarkers. Can you tell us a little bit more about how this contributes to our knowledge about post-arrest brain injury? Does it give us any insight into the physiology between biomarkers and EEG?
Yeah, I actually think it does, because we did not only analyze highly malignant EEG patterns, which are burst suppression or suppressed EEG background. We could show that they have very elevated NFL levels, which we conclude is due to substantial brain injury. We did also analyze the EEG background and the discharges separately, and we do find that they both were associated with higher NFL levels, but the EEG background had the stronger association of the two. And this maybe might be explained by the patients with a totally suppressed background. These patients actually show a trend to have higher NFL levels when they don't have any discharges on the EEG compared to when discharges were present. And this could mean that a brain that is still able to produce discharges but no background may be less injured than a brain that is able to produce neither. It is important to note, though, that the NFL levels were substantially elevated in both of these group of patients, which indicate a poor outcome, of course.
I thought that was one of the most interesting findings about how the EEG background was more strongly correlated with the NFL than the discharges, although both were correlated. Can you tell me a little bit more about EEG and specifically how you use it clinically in post-cardiac arrest? What's the relevance of the timing post-arrest, the TTM period and the TTM trial, et cetera?
Well, to start with the timing, it has been shown to be crucial for prognostication since the EEG patterns may change considerably during the first days after cardiac arrest. So immediately after resuscitation, the EEG is completely suppressed, also in patients that may have a good outcome later. An early return of a continuous background would be a strong predictor of good outcome, but on the other hand, if the EEG fails to improve during the first few days and the background is still suppressed or burst suppression, this would strongly indicate a poor prognosis. But the exact timing of the EEG for prognostication purposes could be debated, and it would be a trade-off between sensitivity and specificity for this method, depending on what time period we would choose. Regarding the TTM period, EEG expression is actually not affected by mild hypothermia. But on the other hand, the sedation that is used during the TTM period may actually affect the EEG in individual patients, especially if high doses are needed. For the majority of patients, sedation does not seem to affect the prognostic value of EEG. In this study, we performed EEGs after the rewarming, corresponding to 36 hours after cardiac arrest or later. And at this late time point, sedation had been stopped in most patients. I just want to mention that we do report one patient that actually had ongoing sedation that needed high doses to tolerate treatment with an aortic balloon pump, who had a highly malignant EEG, but a good outcome. But this patient also had NfL levels in what we would presume is a normal range for their age group.
I think it's really interesting and points to something that gets highlighted in the guidelines about all of this, which is the importance of using multimodal modalities when you're thinking about prognostication and also making sure to be aware of confounding by things like medication. So I think it's very important to point out that, you know, these EEGs were done after the rewarming period and ideally with sedation minimized. Let me switch gears a little bit and talk about the patient population that was in this particular subgroup study of the bigger TTM trial. How did TTM participating sites decide who got routine EEG and serum biomarkers? Are there any implications for this in your cohort?
Well, serum NfL was a separate sub-study in the TTM trial, and thus not all sites contributed this data. The routine EEG, on the other hand, was mandated in all comatose patients after the temperature intervention at all participating sites. Unfortunately, we had to exclude some sites since they were unable to export EEG data in adequate quality. The patients that had true missing data did not differ from the included population. But due to the matter that only comatose patients were included, our results can of course only be generalized for patients that were still comatose after 36 hours after cardiac arrest. But this is also the group of patients where neuroprognostication is relevant.
It's a perfect segue, I think, into my next question, which is thinking about differences in this population within this cohort compared to the broader TTM population, which you all very nicely highlighted in the article. Some of the things that we noticed were that the patient population studied here had a longer duration of cardiac arrest, higher rates of poor outcomes, et cetera. And as you point out, probably would be expected because they were still comatose at the time of the EEG being done. What are the implications for interpretation of the results looking at this cohort versus the broader TTM cohort?
Well, as you already said, it was expected that our cohort would have a worse outcome than the broader TTM population, which is because the EEG recording was only relevant in the patients who were still comatose at the time point of prognostication. We can only generalize our results for this patient population that are still comatose at time point for prognostication. So patients that wake up before a prognostication or die due to other reason before prognostication, we can't say anything about their potential EEG that might have been recorded before the event.
I think it's so important to highlight how to apply results or generalize results to one's patient that's in front of them versus what the research study is. So it's really helpful to highlight that. Continuing along that theme, how do you use EEG and post-arrest prognostication? And do you combine it with other serum biomarkers like NfL in clinical practice?
So in our hospital, all cardiac arrest patients are actually routinely monitored both with a continuous EEG and also full montage routine EEG for prognostic purposes. Currently, we don't use NfL for prediction of outcome, but we do hope that novel biomarkers such as NfL may soon become available. We follow the European guidelines for prognostication, so we don't use solely EEG and biomarkers.
How do you think practice might change, or have you changed practice at all based on the results of this study?
No, we actually didn't change anything. But we think that our results actually reassure us that what we do right now is the right thing, and that the classification that we use for EEG findings is robust for prediction of functional outcome.
Let me ask you this. What work do you think is left to be done? And if you were designing the next research study in this area, what would be next steps?
Well, of course, we would love to validate our results in a separate cohort, and we're actually planning to do that with the ongoing TTM2 trial. And overall, our ambition is to actually further evaluate like electrophysiology, but also imaging, biomarkers, and clinical examination in the setting of neuroprognostication. We also have an ambition to look at indicators of good outcome, even more closely, and we're interested in finding tools to find the patients that may have a good prognosis and not only the ones with a poor outcome.
I certainly think there's still a lot of work to be done in this field. So thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is Stacey Clardy, your podcast editor. We love bringing you practical, relevant, and timely neurologic education around the world, wherever you are, for free. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll continue to join us twice a week, every week.